You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
Today on The Scoop, the ceremonial longhouse, known as the First People's Gathering House, opened at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby this week. Danny Nesvrandi at CJSF has more. And Lauren McKenzie at CHLY Nanaimo tells us how Vancouver Island University is working to keep students safe through harm reduction education. And finally, the BCGEU strike in BC's north continues into its second week as workers continue to fight for fair wages. Pam Hassan at CACK News in Smithers dives in. I'm Dan Messick, and you're listening to The Scoop.
This is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On September 12th, the First People's Gathering House on Simon Fraser University's Burnaby campus opened its doors to the public. First announced in September of 2020, the First People's Gathering House has been discussed as a ceremonial longhouse that will serve to celebrate Indigenous knowledge and culture at SFU. The Gathering House represents the four host nations whose unceded traditional lands SFU Burnaby was built on: the Musqueam Nation, the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, the Squamish Nation, and the Coquitlam Nation. Before the opening ceremony, CJSF was able to get an inside look of the First People's Gathering House, where we spent time in the building's Great Hall. The space has very intentionally been wrapped inside and out with cedar, a traditional longhouse building material. While looking through the space, we were able to speak with Alden Yellowhorn, an SFU professor with the Department of Indigenous Studies and a member of the building committee for the First People's Gathering House. While the plans for this building are only several years old, according to Yellowhorn, its creation has been talked about since his time at SFU in the 1990s.
Prior to this, the Indigenous community didn't really have much of a footprint here on campus. And this building really stands in stark contrast to that brutalist style of architecture that is, you know, very part of Arthur Erickson's design. And this creates kind of an architectural dialogue between the very organic ideas of this space and concrete and edged corners of the rest of the university.
Yellowhorn then went on to describe more of the architectural intentions of the First People's Gathering House.
The way we designed the place with the architect, you know, taking the traditional or the vernacular architecture of local First Nations and using that as the template for creating the physical structure so that even somebody walking past here, it takes like 2 minutes to walk past here, but they'll learn something about First Nations people in that time. So we designed it. Everything is designed to highlight the local culture from the interior design, but also the landscape. We used native plants to do the landscaping and kind of really emphasizing local area, the local area and what it means, like the place Lukluk-Waitin, the place of arbutus trees. And so we're looking, even if you look at the outside of the building, it's designed to look like arbutus trees, the bark of arbutus trees, you know, and as the building ages, it'll take on that resemblance more.
Lastly, we asked Alden Yellowhorn what the community response and interest have been so far for the First People's Gathering House.
Oh, well, we've already had a lot of interest in the space, you know, for people wanting to hold special classes, to invite guest speakers who are coming to SFU, but also to hold special gatherings for their departments. So we're just waiting until after the opening is done, and then we'll start taking bookings. And by then we'll have a fee structure on how much we'll be charging for the use of the space and whatnot.
In the Great Hall of the First People's Gathering House, there are four house posts that have been carved by a member of each of the four host nations. Before the opening, we had the opportunity to speak with Lyle Sparrow, a carver from the Musqueam Nation, who shared with us the personal meaning of the house post that he carved and what it depicts.
When the Kamloops thing came out, given our past history on the boarding schools, I just wanted to honor the ones that were left and never found. So that's the meaning behind the pole, is Mother Earth on the bottom, giving, passing the young ones up to grandfather and freeing them. I don't know, there's just a lot of bad history about it, and my parents went through it, and it wasn't until later years that I found out, you know, what had happened to them, and, you know, sort of had me in a mode of thinking of, you know, like the other people across this country that went through the, you know, similar things, and, you know, just to honor them and, you know, give some healing to the ones that are still here and free the ones that are not. And, you know, thanks to Kamloops, it's worldwide. You know, it's not something that you can dismiss anymore and say, no, it never happened. It happened, and, you know, like I said, I'm kind of proud of my parents, too, where they never really brought it up about what really happened to them in the boarding schools. But when I learned what did happen, it sort of hurts the heart.
Lyle Sparrow then went on to explain his personal experience carving this house post and some of what it brought up for him.
I mean, there were some days where it was hard, you know, because my mind is, you know, with the pole, what I was doing. And then, but at the same time, thinking back on, you know, different things that came to light as I was growing up. You know, so like I said, there were hard days and there were good days.
Later in the day, the public opening ceremony began, which included opening words from local indigenous elders from the Squamish and Musqueam Nations, as well as various song and dance performances, including from the Red Tail Spirit Singers. Now that the First People's Gathering House at the SFU Burnaby campus has opened, it will be available to pre-invited guests from 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., Monday to Friday. This has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is a CJY News Update. As many new and returning students are settling into campus life at Bank Rhode Island University, the campus's Health and Wellness Center wants to educate students to make sure they know the impacts of the ongoing toxic drug crisis. Stephanie Begri and Chantel Amistad are two fourth-year nursing students at Bank Rhode Island University. In their studies, they have been learning a lot about the toxic drug crisis and how it impacts the community in Nanaimo and at BIU.
This year alone, there's been 915 unregulated drug deaths, and out of all of those, 104 of them are between the ages of 19 to 29, so that's about the like university age. So the more people we have trained here, I think the safer the community can be, and we could all make a difference in like saving a life.
That was Amistad speaking about the deadly impacts the illicit drug supply has already had this year. Knowing the importance of education, Amistad and Bagri have started volunteering to offer a short-form version of naloxone training at school events through the VIU Health and Wellness Center. CHY met with them as they were offering the free training and education at the VIU Student Union's Back to School Frosh Concert event held on campus Thursday night. Amistad says offering harm reduction on campus will teach students how to be more prepared in case of an overdose.
Harm reduction itself can seem like a very intimidating topic and overwhelming, and there's a lot of learning to do, and me myself, like, I'm just getting into the topic and learning about it, and I feel like it may not seem like you're doing a large part or learning a lot, but just engaging with the topic in itself and gain that information is just helping destigmatize the topic overall.
Bagri says that university students are at a very vulnerable age for substance use.
Substances, whether they're legal or illicit, substance use is going to happen. Especially with university students, like, they're entering new environments a lot of the times, meeting new friends, like, they're going to be more likely to be experimenting with things. So it's important for them to be able to know how to do use substances safely, and that comes along with knowing how to administer naloxone.
Bagri says that while people cannot control whether or not other people will use drugs, people can still reduce harm and control how they react in the community.
I think, you know, stigma acts as a big barrier to helping those who use substances. So I think getting to be more familiar with harm reduction can definitely help, you know, build like a stronger, more compassionate community.
As a registered nurse and harm reduction advocate, Sarah Lovegrove has seen firsthand how harm reduction can save lives. As a nursing professor at VIU, she says harm reduction training at a university or college is one of the most important spaces to offer the training.
In university, young people are experimenting and they're exploring who they are. And oftentimes that comes with engaging in altered states of consciousness, utilizing substances, and that goes far beyond alcohol.
She warns that in recent years, the toxic drug crisis has made all illicit drugs unpredictable in terms of its poignancy and content. She says that young people need to understand what they could potentially be getting into.
And so this is really starting their journey from a safety lens, from a place of understanding that risks are possible with this. And a lot of prohibition narratives around that really, you know, teach people that drugs are bad, don't do drugs. But then they leave home and they enter university and they start going to parties and realize that a lot of people are experimenting with substances, but they don't have the education between not using and potentially using for the first time, what the risks really are in that.
Lovegrove co-created the VIU Harm Reduction Alliance at the university 3 years ago to create conversations around the toxic drug crisis and harm reduction. The Harm Reduction Alliance has been tabling at various back-to-school events this year, and Lovegrove says they have been hearing a lot from students. She says that while some students may not be ready to learn about harm reduction or take naloxone training, there are still some who get excited knowing this education is being offered on campus.
And then there's also some students who come with such enthusiasm and so much gratitude around this being offered on campus because they know their risks. They've lost friends, they've lost family, and they don't know how to obtain this training and these resources elsewhere.
Lovegrove says it's important for students who are using substances or may want to experiment with substances for the first time that more than ever, substances that are not directly from a pharmacy are likely to be contaminated and in need of testing.
Being aware is really important. And so taking a moment between being offered and taking and saying, what is in this? What do I know about this drug? What do I know about the source? Do I trust the source? And if the answer is I don't know or no to any of those questions, it's not a just say no situation, but it's also just an invitation to explore services.
Drug testing can be done at the Nanaimo Overdose Prevention Site at 250 Albert Street. As well, fentanyl testing strips can be found at the Campus Health and Wellness Center. Lovegrove highlights the story of 18-year-old Sydney McIntyre Starko, who died of an accidental fentanyl poisoning in her dorm at the University of Victoria in January 2024. Sydney's friends and family called on the university for what they say could have been a preventable death if Sydney or her friends had access to naloxone that night. An external review of that night found that the campus security, after arriving, waited 9 minutes to administer the life-saving naloxone and waited 12 minutes to start CPR. While in the past, the VIU Harm Reduction Alliance offered free naloxone training through Island Health for the campus, VIU has worked with the Alliance to take on facilitating the training through its Health and Wellness Center. Naloxone kits can be found at the VIU Health and Wellness Center in Building 200 on the third floor. Nasal naloxone kits have been placed across the campus near defibrillators and the first aid kit in case of an on-campus overdose. The VIU Health and Wellness Center will offer a two-hour naloxone training for the VIU community on Friday, September 26th from noon to 2 p.m. in Building 210. Registration for the training can be found on their Eventbrite. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This is CICK News. Today marks 2 weeks into the BC General Employees Union strike as talks with the provincial government have stalled. The province's public service agency is the employer at the table, and this main public service agreement covers over 34,000 BC GEU members, from BC wildfire crews and correctional officers to liquor and cannabis staff, child welfare workers, and thousands of administrative professionals across government ministries. The union's main demands include competitive wages for public service workers, fair access to telework or remote work, a modernized contract that better values their work, and protection for union jobs. As of Monday, September 15th, over 6,000 BCGEU members are taking job action with 19 picket lines and an overtime ban to pressure the BC Public Service Agency to return to the bargaining table. About 4,500 BCGEU members at 22 work sites are on strike, and picket lines are up across the province, including here in Smithers at the Knorr Building on Alfred Ave at the end of town. I went to the picket line at 3726 Alfred Ave on Friday to get a pulse check on how this strike is affecting the workers so far. But leading into that, let's hear my interview with Paul Finch, president of the BC General Employee Union, to get up to speed on the strike as of yesterday.
Currently, there's over 4,000 members of that group who are on a targeted strike action. And we've done that to minimize the disruption to the general public, to try and maximize the effect on government, to compel them to come back to the table and to negotiate a deal, which they've so far refused to do. So right now, there's an array of core services, primarily inward-facing, so not that wouldn't generally impact the public. And that's everything from IT to finance operations to resource permitting and so on.
And that is what I learned when I went to go visit the workers who were walking around the Knorr Building here in Smithers, is kind of that it is a little more internal. But in speaking to also our MLA, Sharon Hartwell, one of her concerns was, when does this start to affect things like infrastructure? So I guess, what are the steps that go from the public not really being affected and it being a little more inward facing to really gathering and collecting strength from the public service workers?
Yeah, well, I think that time's coming soon. I mean, what we're seeing is government is still refusing to come back to the table and negotiate or move off the position that they took. The last position they took in July that was roundly rejected by our members, 93% voted in favor of a strike over that position. So very clear message from our membership. So right now, again, we've taken time to or care to minimize disruption to the public. That's going to start to change over the next several weeks as, you know, to try and compel government to come back to the negotiating table. So on Friday, for example, we've issued an overtime ban at the liquor and cannabis distribution warehouses. Now, that's just an overtime ban right now. We haven't taken any strike action there, but we're being very measured in our approach. We want to compel government to come back and negotiate a deal.
So what position or demands has the BCGEU made that you know that affect more northern and rural remote government employees?
Well, I was just up in the north on Saturday and I spoke directly to several of our stewards that are on the Smithers picket line. The wages just haven't caught up. Over the past decade, the average wage in the province went up 12% higher than the average wages in the civil service. So today, the average wage in the civil service is 2.7% below the average wage in the province. That's felt in rural communities. You see the purchasing power come down quite a bit. That impacts the local economy, especially where you have a significant number of provincial government employees.
But what does a fair offer look like from the BC Public Service Agency?
What we're hoping to see is government come back to the table with a revised monetary offer. And of course, if they do, we'll engage in obviously good faith negotiations with them.
Is there anything else that you think is really important for our listeners in Smithers and Telkwa and Whitsett, our smaller communities here, to know about this and how this is going to affect them in the future or even starting today?
Well, this is, you know, what's been already affecting us is the purchasing power of, obviously neighbors, friends, family, the people that work in the civil service that provide these services directly to the community. I mean, the wildfire crews out of Smithers and Telkwa, the typical wildfire fighter there is making $28 an hour, right? And so what's prompting, this strike action, while you saw 93% of our membership vote in favor of strike action, is they're simply falling behind too fast, too much, and have been falling behind for the last decade. Our contract was below inflation over the last 3 years. It was below inflation over the last 10 years. That's not acceptable.
Did you connect with our MP or MLA while you were here?
No, I didn't have the opportunity.
Mr. Finch, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you to BCGEU President Paul Finch for his time. Now let's hear from workers at the end of town in Smithers at the Nora Building, where many ministries operate from.
Hey, my name is Ryan Lapointe. I'm a biologist working for the provincial government, and I'm a member of the BCGEU.
Okay, so I guess just very plainly, talk to me about what we're doing here today.
Yeah, so members across the province and at our work site here in Smithers, we are picketing. We are concerned that the province has been offering us wages that are below inflation. We earned below inflation for our last collective agreement when inflation was high. And once again, inflation is greater than what we've been offered. So we're trying to make our voices felt through collective action.
Okay. And so how long have you been striking in front of the Nora Building here?
So we started here on Tuesday this week.
So I guess talk specifically about how you feel workers in the north have been affected by wages not being met by inflation.
Yeah, so I mean, people are obviously struggling more than they used to with grocery bills, but also far more importantly than just the baseline of inflation, housing costs have gone up dramatically. One of the reasons the employer is saying that they can't afford this is the budget. However, they cut government revenues by over $2 billion this year with the carbon tax cut. It saved me personally a few hundred dollars a year, maybe. My mortgage is thousands of dollars a month more than it would have been without a housing crisis and without that functioning from government. For a lot of workers, that's the only way they can afford to live on the wages they earn is by not living in some of our urban centers. So it's pushing more people into communities in the north because they can't afford it to be in those communities. I love this community. I love living here. I live here by choice. I think most people do, but not having that option, some people don't have the choice, and that's where they're being forced. They're renting a basement in a smaller town in the rural where it used to be very affordable.
What's it like when you're on the line and you're circling the building right now with your signs? What kind of support or maybe even not support are you seeing from the public?
We've had very good support from the public. Our office is in a bit of a quiet part of town, but we've had overwhelmingly positive support from people that's gone by. We've had a number of people honking their horns and waving at us with thumbs ups and smiles. So it's actually been quite a positive experience.
What services are being stopped right now due to the strike?
So a number of services out of this building are going to be affected, primarily things tied to permitting, hunting, long-term regulation of, say, environment, streams, water quality. These are all impacted services, planning, working with First Nations. But of course, the biggest thing is the permitting and inspecting for mines and forestry. All that planning is halted.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Good afternoon. I am Sharon Hartwell, MLA for Bulkley Valley Stikine. I'm here with Pam in my office in Smithers, and we're going to have a few questions about the strike.
As a Conservative representative, do you feel like you support this strike?
Well, I think I support people earning a decent wage, and I find it very difficult when people feel that they have to go out on strike to get their needs met. So I don't want to comment on the ins and outs of the strike because that's not my place to do that. That's between the government and the union. But having said that, I think that people deserve to have their needs met and their voice heard. But on the other hand, if the government of the day had actually listened to the unions early on, maybe we could have avoided it. So I'm hoping they're going to go back to arbitration and talk about what's needed. And you talked about what's concerned in the area and the rural communities. And for us here, it's We're doing a lot of work with roads and maintenance and also infrastructure projects that were in the works, as it were. And having them stalled right now before winter is not a good thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I respect the fact they have the right to have their needs met and to be out and voicing those concerns. I respect that.
Mm-hmm. Are you hearing otherwise from the public? Just people's concerns about the strike or how they're being affected?
Not yet. We haven't. But I know that there's always been kind of a little bit of pushback by access to offices because things are a little more difficult the way things are going now, or people aren't in the offices where they can be reached for mm-hmm. information. And I think that's been an ongoing concern for some time for the public overall, not just particularly for this strike. So finding out, I guess, the right balance for access to government officials and government agencies that are necessary for everyday life for the communities, having the offices located in your community should have access. But on the other hand, like I said, people need to have their voices heard, and they have every right to do that. It's a big stand to give up your time and to be out there because they're not gaining any income to speak of, and they have families. Mm-hmm. So I think, especially in northern and rural communities overall, it seems like our voice is really hard to be heard, mm-hmm. and that's always concerned me. So I completely understand the fact that they're trying to make their voice noticed and worthwhile.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.
This is Bird Note. Before the high-tech gadgets used to track bird migration today, a Louisiana ornithologist studied migration with one simple tool, a telescope aimed at the moon. George Lowry dreamed up moonwatching in the 1940s to prove that birds regularly migrated across the Gulf of Mexico. He knew you could see the silhouettes of migrating birds passing in front of the full moon through a telescope. Working with an astronomer, Lowry turned moonwatching counts into standardized measurements to compare the amount of migration at different places and times. On a ship docked on the coast of Yucatan, Lowry pointed his telescope out over the Gulf. He calculated that 3,700 birds crossed an imaginary one-mile line on the water every hour. Then, in the 1950s, he organized the first continent-wide survey of migration patterns with thousands of volunteers across North America. Moonwatching became obsolete once scientists began using radar to monitor migration. But you can still point a telescope at the moon and see those flickering silhouettes of birds on the move. Learn more about the history of bird migration research in Rebecca Heisman's book, Flight Paths, how a passionate and quirky group of pioneering scientists solved the mystery of bird migration. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
My name's Eric Swanson, and I'm a dad of two young girls. It was a game changer when we learned that $10 a day childcare was being offered to both our kids. And we want all BC families to have this option. To get there, BC has to do three key things. Pay fair and consistent wages for all childcare educators. Transition all existing programs to $10 a day. And plan childcare expansion more like we do schools and hospitals. BC's on the right track, but we need to go faster. Go to 10aday.ca to learn more.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. This is edition 283. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be featuring a conversation that I had with Syrian activist and academic Razan Rzawi. Razan spoke to me from Damascus, Syria, And I think is a really important and insightful voice in relation to what is actually taking place on the ground in Syria today from the perspective of a long-term social activist.